ഹവംഗ്ലം തത്തജീവനം കവിഭിരീടിതം കൽമഷാഫകം ശ്രവണമംഗളം ശ്രീമതാതതം ഭുവി ഗൃണന്തി ഭൂരിതാജനാ. Towards the end of the last meeting with Yam, Sri Ramakrishna gives a final instruction to his disciple. Yam asks, "Sir, how ought one to live in the world as an householder?" This is a fundamental question, which Yam was very much in need of an answer for. So Master says, "Do all your duties with your mind always fixed on God. As for your parents, your wife, your children and others, serve them as if they were your own, but know in the inmost recesses of your heart that they are not really yours, unless they too love the Lord. The Lord alone is really your own, and also those who love the Lord." It's a very interesting principle. Many people learn this when they are taught by their husbands, their wife and children, but they learn the hard way. So instead of waiting for this unpleasant mode of instruction, informal instruction from their own near and dear ones, whom they mistook to be theirs, it's better to begin with this conviction in mind. Then you can avoid shock. You can avoid being swept off your feet. And people can avoid anxiety. They can avoid complaint. So, it's a very important principle which Sri Ramakrishna says. Very often people don't believe this. You ask a youngster, "You should not look upon your near and dear ones of your own." He won't believe you. Of course, he may believe after some time when he gets it there. So it's always better for the wise person to learn before the blow comes, before the shocking experience teaches them, when then they are forced to learn the hard way. It is in this context that Sri Ramakrishna gives the example of a maidservant doing all her duties, performing all the responsibilities in the rich man's home, looking after the children of the rich man, thinking, at least apparently pretending to be very affectionate towards them. She has to look after them. But the same children have the right to kick her out any moment. It could happen. So she normally keeps her affection, real affection for her own children who may be living far away in a small hut. Similarly, it's better for us to remember the beginning itself. There is an interesting story which Sri Ramakrishna tells elsewhere to drive home this point. A guru, a spiritual teacher, instructed his disciple that, "Look here, you should look after all your relations, children, wife, husband, but whoever may be. Great care. But remember, God is the only true friend of yours." But the disciple was not willing to believe. He said, "No, this is one point which I can't agree with you. Is that all my relations are very near and dear. They are dear to me and I am dear to them." Then the guru wanted to teach the disciple. He was a good man, so he didn't leave him at that stage. He was the higher guru, you know, the one who enforces his instruction on the disciple. So he gave him some medicine, which apparently makes the person lifeless. He doesn't die, but he appears to be dead. All breathing, metabolism, all stopped. So he was lying there, almost like a corpse. Then, but he was a huge man, well built, quite fat. So it was a small home. Now the dead body had to be taken to the cremation ground. In those days they used to cremate the body in the compound of the home itself. So the dead body had to be taken out. The door was small. So, the undertaker may have suggested, look here, the body is somewhat big, so why don't you break that door? Then the wife began, if you break the door, how can we leave? So better cut the body into a few pieces and take it in installments also. And the same suggestion came from other relations. And the man was listening to all these wonderful suggestions from his near and dear ones. So his children suggested, he better cut the hand. Maybe wife might have suggested cut the leg. Some much more intelligent close relative must have suggested cut the head, so that later you can put together the time of cremation. Anyhow, this man listened to all this and they all thought this man is dead. But suddenly he woke up because he was not really dead. Maybe his teacher, the sage, may have given him another medicine, administered another medicine, antidote, and he came back to life. So this is a wonderful affection you had for me. Okay. He left the home immediately. He need not leave the home. Why should he leave the home? He should continue living there. But he should learn the lesson and then continue living in his home. He should continue looking after his children, looking after all his relations, with the same affection, with the same love, with the same sense of obligation and sense of duty. But he should keep this wisdom somewhere in his pocket. Then he can live in this world as an intelligent person. That's the instruction the Siddhamsa gives. Now we are coming to one of the most touching scenes in the Gospel of Siddhamsa. And it's supposed to be one of the most important and one of the most touching scenes in the Gospel of Siddhamsa. As I said earlier, Sri Ramakrishna's disciple Kesachandra Singh was a prominent citizen of the city, a celebrity among the intellectuals of the city. He was a prominent Brahma Samaj leader. Now, I shall give you the background, as I gave earlier, but to remind you, there were three prominent reformist movements in India in the 19th century. One was Raja Ram Mohan Roy's Brahma Samaj, which he founded in the year 1828. It was a very somewhat conservative movement, mostly focusing on social reforms. I mean, arguing the case of widow marriage and putting an end legally for the diabolical custom that prevailed in that part of the country, that is sati. It means widow burning, terrible. So of course it was stopped. It was practiced in some places, the wife herself voluntarily following her dead husband to the hell or heaven, whatever. This is the practice. It was legally stopped thanks to the efforts of great social reformers like Rajaram Mohan Roy and also maybe Lord Bendinck, who was the Governor General of Bengal at that time, undivided Bengal. At that time included today's West Bengal, Bangladesh, Tripura, parts of maybe the whole of Northeast, and the eastern districts of Bihar. It's huge land area. So this was stopped. So that was a great role which Rajaram Mohan Roy played. But the same organization took another form afterwards. He became somewhat radicalized and much more modern. And this great leader, Kesavachandra Sen, deviated from the teachings of the earlier conservative movement, and he started what came to be known as a new dispensation, Brahma Samaj. Swami Vivekananda and many other learned young intellectuals, thinkers, were all members of this movement, and they used to listen to the oration, to the speeches and lectures of great leaders like Kesavachandra Sen. There was another one, Vijay Krishna Goswami, who was more of a conservative, devoted type of leader. The other movement was Arya Samaj, which was founded in Punjab and Gujarat. He was a Gujarati Brahmin who was an outstanding Sanskrit scholar, Vedic scholar, whose influence was mostly confined to parts of Gujarat, most of Punjab, including today's, today about 50% of today's Pakistan state, and also many parts of India. It was known as Arya Samaj. It was followed by the great monk, Dayananda Saraswati, this great Sanskrit scholar, who argued that Vedic rituals constitute the essence of Vedic philosophy. The third movement had its origin in 1876, most probably that's here, in New York. It was founded by a Russian woman known as Madame Blavatsky, and perhaps a retired infantry officer from British Army, whose name was Colonel Olcott. So they founded this Theosophical Society, which was also a kind of reformed radical movement. These were the three organizations. Later on, the Theosophical movement was introduced to India by the Irish aristocratic woman known as Annie Besant, Dr. Annie Besant. She loved India, she was a staunch Hindu. The point which I'm going to stress from here is Keshav Chandra Sen was a radical, modern, reformist Brahma Samajik who was well known among the intellectual circles of Calcutta, who had already visited England and delivered a number of lectures as the guest of the Unitarian Church in many parts of England and many other parts of British Empire. So she was a prominent person. He did not believe in temple worship, image worship. He did not believe in the highest peak of Vedanta philosophy, namely non-dualism, Advaita. At the same time, he also did not believe the beginning of spiritual evolution, that's called image worship. So his system was what you call, in according to Annie Besant, who made an interesting statement, Keshav tried to reform Hinduism. Eventually, he Christianized Hinduism. That was the verdict given by Annie Besant. The reason is Keshav Chandra Sen figures as one of the pioneering Christologists in India. Christology, the science of biblical studies, focusing on Jesus and his teachings exclusively, not giving much importance to theological trappings. So Keshav Chandra Sen, P.C. Majumdar, Kalicharan Banerjee, and many of these leaders were among the pioneering leaders of Christology in India. And they were also prominent Hindu reformers. They had not become converts to Christianity because the concept of converting possibly did not prevail in those days, because they were all influenced by the reform movement, is called Unitarian Universalism, which was also prominent in the United States at that time, which influenced the teachings, the thought currents of Emerson, Thoreau, Whitman, and many others of the later decades of 19th century. So Keshav Chandra Sen, and just to give an example, what sort of person he was, very big celebrity of those days, a very big radical intellectual, a great lecturer, a great orator, who had a great influence on the thinking minds, especially the youngsters, the products of the modern university education, in the last decades of 19th century. He was a great devotee of Sri Ramakrishna. It may be much better to say that he was a great admirer of Sri Ramakrishna. So he used to visit Dakshineswar temple, go to Sri Ramakrishna's room, the small room where he lived, but he wouldn't go to the temple. In fact, it's very difficult for anyone to go to Sri Ramakrishna's temple, so his room, without going to the temple. As on many occasions, he just went there by boat. And when you get down from the boat, normally any man in his proper senses will go to the temple and go down there. But it is said that in the record history of Brahma Samaj leaders, he very rarely went in front of the shrine and go down to the Divine Mother. So he did not accept her, the Divine Mother. The Bodharani temple, he did not. Formally, he did not accept the Divine Mother. But he had a great admiration for the spiritual teachings. He had learned the Upanishads But mostly he interpreted the great Vedantic text more or less as a pantheistic description of Godhead. Pantheism means equating God with empirical nature. That's universal nature. That's called pantheism. In fact, it is one of the earliest stages of the Vedic evolution of Godhead. The first stage, pantheism, panentheism, monotheism, henotheism, and monism. These are the five stages of evolution. I'm not going to details of this context. Now, this man was an admirer of Siddhamashma. Later, towards the end of his life, he surrenders himself to the Divine Mother. And towards the end, Siddhamashma goes to his home, Kamalkoti Lily Cottage, in the year 1883, at 2 p.m. 28th of November 1883. That day, Siddhamashma visits Kesachindra Singh. He had only a few months to live. He had become terribly ill. He had gone sick earlier. He was ill on many earlier occasions, but Siddhamashma was very much concerned and prayed to the Divine Mother, and he recovered. But this time, Siddhamashma was not so much perturbed. He felt, perhaps, that this man's life was coming to an end, and also the fulfillment of his life. Because the moment it was known, it came to be known to him that Kesachindra Singh was talking to Divine Mother, was communicating with Divine Mother, praying to the Divine Mother of the universe with prayers and tears in his eyes, Siddhamashma understood, well, this man's spiritual fulfillment is approaching. He won't live for a long time. That is the part of the gospel that we are going to read today. So the scene begins like this. It was past 2 p.m. on the 28th Wednesday of November 1883. I'm reading Yem's own translation of his own diary, which he originally wrote down in Bengali. A young man was there seen walking up and down the footpath of the circular road before Lily Cottage. The young man, Yem himself. The footpath runs close to the cottage, north and south. That's a cottage where Kesachindra Singh lived. A number of his followers, those who belonged to his own dispensation of the Brahma Samaj, also had settled there. So they used to hold meetings frequently. They will sing bhajans, Kesachindra Singh will give lectures, and they used to have this sort of meetings frequently. And many of Siddhamashma's disciples, sometimes Swamiji at that time, Narendranath himself, used to attend these gatherings and prayer meetings frequently. Siddhamashma loves Kesav. He will come today to see him. Yem is writing down his own thoughts. He has by this time left the temple of Dakshineswar for Calcutta. The Lily Cottage, that is the place where Kesav lived, is in the city of Calcutta, and Dakshineswar temple a few miles away from the city. It is this that kept the young man, his disciple, pacing up and down the footpath, awaiting his beloved master's disciple. Carriages come to view one after another, and every time he looks up to see if Siddhamashma is coming. So he is walking up and down, pacing up and down the road, close to the house of Kesachindra Singh, where Siddhamashma is coming to visit him. Now, Yem's thoughts enters another plane. All is not right there. Now he says, north of the college building, this college building is called Victoria College, where the ladies, girls of the Brahma leaders were getting their education, the Victoria College, that is close to this home. North of this college building, there's a garden house, the residence of an English gentleman. The young man has this house also in full view before him. So he's walking up and down. In front of him, he sees he's watching this home, this house of Englishman. Something is happening there. He's closely observing. and he becomes a philosopher, as you observe. See, is the context here. All is not right there. As you observe for a long time, there is hurrying to and fro among the inmates of the house. See, remember, it's old English, so he was educated in the mid-Victorian age, so he's the old style. And their looks are sad. Presently, come on the scene the ominous years, and the drivers and servants were served in black. So horse carriage came to carry a dead body out of the home. So there were servants, retainers, and other members of the home to come out to see the carriage in which a dead body had to be taken to the cremation ground. They were all wearing black clothes. They wear the livery of death, for it is he, death, who has visited the home. The spirit has passed away, the human soul has left the body of clay. So body of clay is remaining, that will be taken to the cremation ground. The soul has left the body. This incident, as he watches, makes him think of the imperishable nature of Atman, soul, that is the eternal reality, and the perishable nature of this human body, which he calls this body of clay. It came into this world out of eternity, it has left the world. Where, says the disciple himself, as he walks up and down, where does the soul pass as it leaves this world, this body? Verily, it is raised out of eternity into eternity. Carriages rattle away before the disciple. He lifts his eyes, but the master has not come. So he's waiting for Sri Ramakrishna's arrival. It is 5 AM. So Sri Ramakrishna's carriage arrived. Latu, one of Sri Ramakrishna's disciples, and 2 or 3 other disciples are with him. Rakhal and Yam are also there. Rakhal was Swami Brahmananda, who later became the great monk, Swami Brahmananda. He is received by Kesar people and is led upstairs. So as Sri Ramakrishna approaches the home, Kesar's relatives, brothers, maybe other relations, came there and received him. Kesar has been taken seriously ill. Hence, his disciples are so very careful about him. Sri Ramakrishna, however, gets more and more impatient to see him. Now, when Sri Ramakrishna reached the home, they received him, but they probably asked him to wait for some time, which Sri Ramakrishna didn't like. He was impatient to meet his disciple, Kesar in the sin. So Sri Ramakrishna appeals to Kesar's disciples, Prasanna, Amrita, and others. These are some of the Brahmo disciples of Kesar sin. Sri Ramakrishna is talking to Kesar's disciples. Well, there's no need of his coming here. Let me go in and see him. They probably told him that Kesar will come downstairs and meet Sri Ramakrishna. But Sri Ramakrishna said, well, he's sick. I will go and meet him there in his room. Prasanna, with all great humility. Sir, kindly wait one moment. He will be here presently. Sri Ramakrishna becomes impatient. Oh dear, it is you who are standing in the way. How long am I to wait to see him? Then Prasanna tries to divert Sri Ramakrishna's attention to another very important topic. That is exactly the central topic of this discussion in this part of the gospel. Prasanna tells Sri Ramakrishna, sir, a great change has come over him, come over Kesar in the sin, the man who never accepted the Divine Mother, who never accepted image worship or temple worship or any of these former external rituals. There is a sudden and complete transformation that has come over him. Like yourself, he is often found talking to the Divine Mother. Like yourself, he hears the Divine Mother's voice and sometimes sheds tears. So when Sri Ramakrishna heard this, his whole mood changes. Does Kesav talk to the Divine Mother and smile and cry like a child? The good news is too much for the Master. He loses all sense consciousness and passes into the state of Samadhi. Now, Prasanna uttered these words actually to divert Sri Ramakrishna's attention. Sri Ramakrishna was getting impatient to go upstairs and meet Kesav. And Prasanna wanted him to wait calmly for some time. So to divert his attention, Prasanna was actually diverting Sri Ramakrishna's attention to another topic without really understanding its significance for Sri Ramakrishna. When Sri Ramakrishna realized that Kesav had already started praying to and communicating with the Divine Mother, he immediately understood that he has already accepted the Mother, and his life mission, the purpose of his association with Sri Ramakrishna, has already been fulfilled. And along with that realization, he also knew that Kesav won't live for a long time. His end was approaching. So all these turned Sri Ramakrishna into a superconscious state, and he passed into the state of Samadhi. There is this God-intoxicated man seated motionless like a statue. These are the words of him, the recorder. It being cold weather, he has on a coat made of green cashmere. He is seated with folded hands. His body is erect. His eyes move not. Deep in Samadhi, he continues in this state for a long time. No sign that this unique state of divine ecstasy is going to leave him. It's evening. They have lighted the drawing room. He is returning to the sense world. They are trying to take him into that room. So, he is seated on a couch. See that the Kesav's room, well furnished, of intellectual celebrity of those days, with cushion chairs, sofas, couches, mirrors on all sides, bookshelves, and gas lights everywhere. But the state of God consciousness has not entirely left him. He smiles like one who has been intoxicated. He looks on the couches and cushioned chairs, mirrors, and dust. He talks to himself, a kind of soliloquy, and to the Divine Mother. Sri Ramakrishna is watching the sofa, the cushion, the costly furniture in the room. These were of use indeed some time back, but now they are of little use. So Kesav used to receive his friends and admirers and intellectuals in that room. They used to sit and discuss topics, intellectual topics like nature of God and things like that. So he was a big man of those days, and all this furniture was necessary. Now Sri Ramakrishna says, now this man has already got his return tickets, though these things won't be of much use. Sri Ramakrishna realized that his bodily existence is coming to an end. This others did not realize. So when Sri Ramakrishna made the statement, what's the use of all these furniture now? Chairs, cushions, sofas. They were all needed till now. Now they won't be of any use in future. Nobody understood what he was thinking. He realized that Kesav's spiritual goal has been fulfilled. In fact, the purpose of his association with Sri Ramakrishna was that his spiritual goal should be fulfilled, and that was he should realize the Divine Mother of the universe. That has happened. So Sri Ramakrishna knew that now he is not going to live for a long time. As I said yesterday, that's a nature, that is a special gift of a great spiritual teacher. He looks at things as one dimension. He doesn't divide events or personalities into past, present and future. When he looks, he can see the past, the future and also the present at one level. Sri Ramakrishna knew that he had already done a lot of spiritual practices in the past, which made him so great an intellectual, a spiritual seeker in this life. But now that he has already come to the end of his spiritual journey, he won't live for a long time. So all these costly furniture, sofas, bookshelves, cushions won't be of any use in future. So he says, these were of use indeed some time back, but now they are of no use. Did the master see with his inner vision that Kesava's hour was come and that he would depart out of this world and go to his divine mother? He would die within a very short time, a couple of years. He looks at Rakhal, young disciple, and other great spiritual seekers who were young boys at that time, but who later become great monks. Then he talks to the divine mother. Here, mother, you also have come. How beautifully dressed you are. Do not trouble thyself, mother. Please take a seat. So Sri Ramakrishna with his inner eye sees the divine mother herself had come at this auspicious moment. You can think of the spiritual journey, the evolution of an elevated soul. Kesava had already done a lot of spiritual practices in the past. That is why he was born as a great seeker, sadhaka. In this life, he had the good fortune to come in contact with the teacher like Ramakrishna Paramahamsa. But he was not willing to accept the divine mother. And finally, by the grace of his guru, it so happened that towards the end of his life, he himself not only accepted the Divine Mother, but was communicating with the Divine Mother of the universe as his own guru. So, all this happened, and Sri Ramakrishna says, the Divine Mother of the universe had herself come there and was present on the scene. The Brahmo devotees have filled the room by this time. Remember, whatever words came from Sri Ramakrishna were not fully intelligible to the average Brahma disciple, the Brahma followers who had assembled, or the other devotees. Sri Ramakrishna had reached another state of consciousness. The moment he was informed that Kesava had already accepted the Divine Mother, that information was enough for him to be transported to a higher level of consciousness. So he already started kind of a soliloquy, and he could see the presence of the Divine Mother on the scene. Here Sri Ramakrishna starts a long conversation. Immortality of the soul is the subject of conversation. The body and the soul. The body has a beginning, it must have an end. The body must die, the soul dies not. So again Sri Ramakrishna was thinking. The great disciple Kesava was approaching his end. His body will come to an end, but the soul will not die along with that. So there's a long discussion on some of the most precious and important principles of practical spiritual life in the coming pages. We may not have time to finish the whole topic today. The soul stands apart from the body. Until one sees God, one cannot help believing that the soul is the same as the body. The idea clings to the ignorant, to him who has not seen God. To the knowing one, it is plain that the soul is not the same as the body. The shell of the unripe bitter nut adheres to the nuts. It is so hard to part the one from the other. Such is not the case with the ripe nut. The shell does not adhere to it. The nut is felt rolling inside if shaken. Now Kesava himself comes there. in this room. Who is that now in this room? A figure made of skin and bones, a veritable specter coming on towards the master. He holds on the wand for support. He comes near the curse. He falls down at the hallowed feet of Siddhanakshana, who is now seated on the carpet of floor and is still in a state of divine consciousness. This very most probably Keshav used to salute Siddhanakshana in a very formal way, but not with the same sense of humility and self-surrender as he's doing now. That's why Yan gives a graphic description of the whole scene. The figure before him is Keshav, or rather wreck of him, who was once Keshav, the hero of 100 platforms, to observe of all observers, the idol of the city, a god-like figure whose very presence was so often inspiring as he sat conducting divine services in the Brahma Sama's temple and poured out his soul like a child in prayer to the Divine Mother, in words never to be forgotten, so forceful, so earnest, so sweet, so charming. He remembered this. Yam is here remembering many of the old scenes when he had met the same Keshav Chandra Sen, healthy person, who could keep his audience spellbound by his oratory, who was a hero of many platforms, who was so influential. Yam himself had attended several of those sessions and lectures. Now, before him, he sees another Keshav. The man had become spiritually an elevated soul, but his body has become a wreck of what it was. So the contrast was so shocking to Yam as he himself translates his own experiences into the English of those days. Still in a state of ecstasy, he looks on Keshav as on one he knows not. Keshav is seated and says aloud, "Here I am, sir. Here I am." Keshav softly struck his left hand. Keshav shouts. In fact, the original text, if you read, "Here I have come," that's what it is. He says, "Here I have come." But no return to the sense world. Siddhamakshana still in the superconscious state of samadhi, drinking deep at the fountain of immortal bliss. A little while later, he talks to himself like one gone mad. Is this the madness of divine love, divine ecstasy? Then Siddhamakshana says, "So long as I do not have a knowledge of my true self, so long as the reality gets out of sight behind substance semblances, I have a perception of many things and persons, as Keshav Amrita Prasanna, perfect knowledge, is knowledge of oneness, of only one reality behind many things, one God behind the phenomenon universe." Siddhamakshana says, "So long as we remain in a state of ignorance, we see the many, we see the manifold, we see plurality, we experience plurality. But when we get the experience, we see the unity of all these appearances. We see oneness behind plurality, non-duality behind duality." That's why he says, "Perfect knowledge is knowledge of oneness, of only one reality behind the many things, one God behind the phenomenal universe. The knowing one sees again is this reality, this universal soul has differentiated itself into living beings and the world, in short, into the 24 categories of the philosopher." So Siddhamakshana here enters another world. He gives a metaphysical and spiritual analysis of the whole phenomenon of spiritual knowledge. When you realize the supreme reality, you find Prakriti, Purusha, and the 23 evolutions of Prakriti, all the 24 principles, including Prajna, all are experienced to be different forms of the one reality behind. The identity of God, the Absolute, and God, the Creator, cannot be made perfectly clear by means of words. Reasoning by analogy only throws some light on it. Now, God the Creator, my Divine Mother, has manifested herself as the 24 categories of the philosopher. Sri Ramakrishna is here referring to the Sankhya philosophy, which says there are two fundamental categories: Prakriti, the conscious but inactive principle, Purusha, the conscious, the inactive principle, and Prakriti, the unconscious but active principle. These are the two fundamental categories in Sankhya philosophy: Purusha and Prakriti. Purusha is conscious but inactive. Prakriti is unconscious, that is called Achetana or Jeta, but it is active. Out of Prakriti, the whole universe and different evolutes come into existence. All the 23 evolutes come into existence through the process of evolution. That's the idea, that's the topic of discussion. In her work involved the human soul and the eternal world. Sri Ramakrishna often equates the Prakriti as the Divine Mother herself. Of course, Prakriti is one aspect of the Divine Mother, the creative, the dynamic aspect of the Divine Mother. Because the entire universe evolves out of the Divine Mother, and the entire universe remains within the Divine Mother, is an involved state. So you have to remember, Sri Ramakrishna refers to the Sankhya system of philosophy, which says there are two fundamental absolute principles, categories: Purusha, the conscious but inactive principle; Prakriti, the unconscious but active principle, which is the source of the whole evolution of the universe. And then, in relation to devotional philosophy, he says, this Prakriti itself is an aspect of the Divine Mother. So the whole universe evolves out of the Divine Mother of the universe, and the whole universe remains within the Divine Mother of the universe as an involved reality, in an involved state. It's called involution, is the state of all the evolutes before their evolution. The evolution is the manifestation of the involved state into grosser dimension. Involved state is the abstract, subtle dimension, and the evolution is the gradual manifestation into grosser dimension. Anyway, we will discuss this later. Now Sri Ramakrishna says, after the harvest has been reaped, one need not any longer go round along the wall. One may walk straight to any point of the field. Is just imagine the imagery of paddy field or maybe wheat field. Now, when the crops are ripe before the harvest, you can't just walk across the field. But once the harvest has been reaped, the field is barren except tiny shrubs, so you can walk straight. Like that, he who has realized God sees that the Lord manifests himself in all things. Above all, he reveals himself in man, more especially in those pure souls who are of themselves fixed upon God and are turned away from the little things of this world. So, Sri Ramakrishna says, this God reality is all-pervading, but that God reveals himself in much more easily to pure souls who is practicing renunciation and who has turned away from worldliness. The thought continues, one who has a sense of darkness has also a sense of light. It's correlative. One who knows the meaning of night also knows the meaning of the day. It is correlative. One who has a feeling of joy has also a feeling of grief. It's correlative. So one should go beyond sukha and dukkha, means happiness and unhappiness, joy and sorrow, good and bad. And this highest state of realization is the spiritual, is the goal of all spiritual practices. Now, in the coming pages, Sri Ramakrishna makes some very interesting remarks. Sri Ramakrishna says, smiling to Kesha, "You are ill. Well, there is a deep meaning in that. There has passed through your body many a deep devotional feeling that searches the Lord. Your illness bears witness to those feelings. Of the havoc done by them to the system, one can form no idea at the time they arise." Means when we practice spirit, when we do spiritual practices, sometimes the body suffers. So Sri Ramakrishna says, your body has gone through several levels of spiritual practices, spiritual realizations. That's why your body is so ill. He gives an example. An elephant entering into a hut soon makes it totter and at last pulls it down. The love for the God is like the elephant in his greatness. It very often pulls down the frail house of clay called a human body. So sometimes spiritual practices may make the body weak and frail. A ship goes past our Devanga, but nobody attends to it. Little while later, big waves are seen beating upon the bank and sometimes washing away portions of it. So what happens to the human body? It's described here. When we do spiritual practices, at that time we may not realize of the impact, the terrible physical strain that is felt by the body. When the ship passes along the river, at that moment we see the river is calm, but after the ship has passed out of sight, suddenly we find waves in the bank and you can see the disturbance, the turbulence. When a house is set on fire, some of the things inside are first burnt up. Then the house is taken up as a whole by the fire and burned. Much the same thing comes to pass when God is seen. The fire of God vision first burns up the various passions, lust, anger, etc. Then the false ego, which says, "I am the doer," and lastly the whole body. That's what happens. So slowly our passions, lower biological drives, all burnt up, and gradually anchor and too much of obsession for the body. "I am the doer and would enjoy the results of my actions." All these feelings, this identity, are all transient. You may think, "Let the Lord's will be done," but no, the physician does not leave the patient unless he is perfectly cured. Your name has been entered as a patient in the hospital books, and you cannot get away till you are seen cured by the physician in charge. Here's an example. We are born in this world. We have to do certain duties and responsibilities. So even at the time of God realization, we may feel we need not live any longer, but that's not possible. There's a divine will behind it, and till that divine will begins to operate, this life will continue. That's the idea behind, and this conversation continues, and finally Sri Ramakrishna realizes that Kesha won't live any longer, for a very long time. The master smiles. Umanath continues, "Sir, mother asks you to bless him so that he may soon get well." Kesav's old mother comes near the room and requests Sri Ramakrishna to bless Kesav so that he will be cured of his illness. But Sri Ramakrishna's response was somewhat different. "Let your prayers be offered up to the Divine Mother, who is made of bliss everlasting. She it is who removes all troubles. All the ills that of the flesh is help the human body. See, on earlier occasions, when Sri Krishna heard, whenever he heard that Keshav was sick, he used to pray for his discovery. He used to pray to Divine Mother. Well, if Keshav goes away, to whom shall I speak? With whom shall I discuss about God and spirituality? So Mother, please keep him healthy. He even gave offerings to Divine Mother for the recovery of Keshav. But on this occasion, Sri Ramakrishna knew that since Keshav had already reached the end of his spiritual journey, he is also approaching the end of his physical journey. So, he knows very well. So, he is a reply, you pray to Divine Mother. It will be better for you not to stay in the inner apartment. Even at this time, Sri Ramakrishna gives some warning, some instructions to Keshav. Though you have accepted the Divine Mother, Mother's grace is on you, still you should practice discipline. Try to live and spend your time mostly immersed in spiritual practices. Towards the end of this chapter, Sri Ramakrishna has a few things to say about Keshav. With that, we'll conclude. How great is Keshav, honored alike by men of the world that seek for wealth and by holy men that seek for the love of God. I once met Dayananda in a garden house. He expected Keshav on that day and was asking everybody if Keshav had come up. So Keshav was acquainted with some of the prominent reformers and religious leaders and scholars of the age. So he was a very prominent person. In spite of all that, he was free from the vulgar pride of the preceptor who comes in his own name. Here, Sri Ramakrishna says, Keshav is free from the vulgar pride of the preceptor who comes in his own name. Very often, he said to many of his disciples, go to the temple of Dakshineswar, where you will have your doubt solved. So whenever some of his prominent disciples came to Keshav, he always referred them to go to Dakshineswar and meet Sri Ramakrishna. So Sri Ramakrishna fully appreciated his humility in spite of his prominence. As a rejoinder, I shall make a few remarks. Keshav slowly realized the truth of the Divine Mother of the universe and became a great devotee. But many of his later followers, the Brahma Samaj leaders, could not fully appreciate Keshav's greatness. Many of them did not recognize. If you read the history of Keshav's Drishyam written by some of the Brahma Samaj leaders, you don't find them fully acknowledging the case of spiritual greatness, his spiritual evolution, the final realization that came to him, was all because of the grace of his great teacher, Sri Ramakrishna himself. But he himself was a very learned person, at the same time, very humble. So Sri Ramakrishna says, yes, Keshav is great, honored alike by men of the world and by the holy men who seek God alone. Yam concludes this chapter. Coming downstairs, the master observes there is no light on the ground floor at the foot of the stairs. So after meeting Keshav, at the upper story of the building, Sri Ramakrishna slowly came down. And when he was coming downstairs, he observed that there was no light on the ground floor at the foot of the stairs. So he says to Amrita, all the Brahma leaders, Keshav's followers, all these places should be lighted, for the Divine Mother abides in every house. Such an omission leads to poverty. So, light is the symbol of prosperity, knowledge, and effulgence, and presence of the Lord. So, he said there should be light everywhere. with two or three disciples, Sri Ramakrishna sets out in a cab on his way back to the temple. It's one of the important scenes in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. The significance is this. One of the most prominent citizens of the city at that time, a great intellectual, but a great man in many other ways, became an admirer of Sri Ramakrishna, though he was not a conventional temple goer. He did not accept image worship. He did not accept temple worship as a Brahma Samaj leader at that time. But gradually, through association with Sri Ramakrishna, he not only accepted the Divine Mother of the universe, but he himself realized, had a vision of the Divine Mother, and it said in this chapter that he started communicating with Divine Mother. He used to shed tears chanting the Mother's name. So you can imagine the impact of a prominent, proud intellectual. The impact on the life of a prominent intellectual like Keshavachandra Sen by his association that came to him, by his association with Sri Ramakrishna. So, this chapter is very important. So, now we are concluding. For want of time, we don't have an interaction session now. So, thank you. Namaskar.
Om Tavakathamurdam Tapta Jeevanam Kavibhiridam Kalmasapaham Sravanamangalam Srimatatadam Vigranti Bhuridachana.